This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 2, 200, or 2 million, Atlassian software is built to keep you connected and moving together as one.
Hello and welcome to Music to My Ears. In this episode, BBC Music Magazine's editor, Oliver Condy, talks to the former Guardian editor and now principal of Lady Margaret Hall, Oxford, Alan Rusbridger. While the editor of a national paper during the Arab Spring, WikiLeaks controversies, the newspaper hacking scandal, riots in the UK and more, Alan Rusbridger found time to learn and perform Chopin's Ballade No. 1, a feat he describes in his book Play It Again. Here we chat about the music and musicians that have been part of his life, but I start by asking him about the role music played during those busy days at The Guardian back in 2011. Before we get going, here's pianist Murray Pariah performing a short passage from that Chopin ballade.
When I was editing The Guardian, and that was really the point of the book that I wrote, Play It Again, music was a kind of emergency escape. So there was so much pressure and relentless work involved in editing a newspaper. But music felt like a sort of necessary little sanctuary. If you could just find 20 minutes a day, then somehow you could get through the day. At Oxford, there is more time to walk about and think and discuss and all the things that universities are famous for, and also to play music collaboratively. So actually, it reminds me of my days when I was at university, when I used to spend, you know, most of my time playing with friends rather than working. And so I suppose music has sort of come back to be more central to me in the last 5 or 6 years.
Because certainly reading Play It Again, it seems to me that music was a bit of a saviour during that particularly knotty time. I mean, you know, as you say in the book, you know, you had the Arab Spring, you had the WikiLeaks, you had the hacking scandal, you had a lot to deal with, and yet you still managed to find time to practice Chopin.
Yeah, and again, that was one of the points of writing the book, was that I think for most people, not continuing with an instrument is one of their biggest regrets. And normally their excuse to themselves, which I'm sure, you know, feels completely genuine, you know, once life intervenes, you think, well, something has to give, and usually it's music. You know, during this incredibly busy time of my life when we were sort of reinventing what newspapers were, as well as doing all these extraordinary stories, to be able to find 20 minutes a day showed that it can be done. But you know, you have to say that, well, that's going to be one of my priorities. And if that means I have to get up 20 minutes earlier in the morning, it's doable. And then the nice sort of afterlife of the book has been the emails that I get every week from some part of the world of somebody saying, well, actually, I've gone back to playing music and it was a huge regret that I stopped, but I've now rediscovered it.
And I think you can do a lot in 20 minutes. I think this is the fallacy, is that, you know, you have to spend 2 or 3 hours a day practicing, and that's the only way that you'll make any progress. But if you concentrated practice for 20 minutes, even a quarter of an hour can make a huge difference.
Yeah. I mean, you're never going to be Murray Pariah on 20 minutes a day. But I was tackling this immensely difficult Chopin ballade, and it's not a pushover by any means. But I did manage it. I definitely got better week by week and day by day. And at the end of 18 months, I could just about play this piece. But if you want to be Murray Pariah, you'd be well advised to play 4 or 5 hours a day. But you know, they're different exercises.
Absolutely. I'd like to sort of go back to sort of the time when you first got into music. You know, obviously, was there much music in your household when you were a kid? I mean, or did you discover the piano sort of slightly independently?
My mother was a, you know, a modest pianist and had wanted to play the flute, did play the flute, and then the family, I think she couldn't afford music lessons. So I think she was a driver in trying to get me to take music seriously. But I suppose the thing that first switched me on was singing choirs as a young boy, and I ended up singing in Guildford Cathedral Choir under a legendary choir director called Barry Rose. I mean, that was an incredible discipline for a boy of, you know, 10 or 11 to, we had a rehearsal every lunchtime, we had a rehearsal every evening, we had Evensong every evening, 6 nights a week. And then you would come home after Evensong, having done music for 3 hours a day, and then have to do your homework. So that was quite a sort of schooling in self-discipline, in confidence, in performance, in sight reading. And alongside that, I also took up the piano and the clarinet. So there was an awful lot of music in the life of a, you know, 11, 12-year-old boy.
So it's fair to say the first piece of music you sort of really loved might have been a choral work.
There were lots of bits of English choral repertoire. I mean, Barry Rose was a sort of unusual person to be running a choir, and had been plucked, as it were, from nowhere to run the Guildford Choir. And we recorded things like J.H. Maunder's Olivet to Calvary, which I thought was, you know, the greatest piece of choral music ever written, until I went to my secondary school and my music master there said, yeah, well, maybe you should try the B minor Mass or the St. John Passion. So, but I think actually the first piece of classical music I really loved was The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra of Benjamin Britten. And I think it was that launched me to play the clarinet, and I played in lots of orchestras, and it's just an extraordinary piece. Later in life, I got to know a man called Sir Dennis Foreman, who had been running Granada TV and I think was deputy chair of the Royal Opera House. Very grand, brave war hero. And over dinner one evening, and he was approaching 90 then. He said that he and his wife had commissioned this piece in 1945, and it was commissioned by the Crown Film Unit for the Ministry of Education. And that makes me extra fond of this piece, because when you think of how the, you know, the diminishing role of music education in schools today, and there was this period just after the war when the Ministry of Education thought it was really important that young people knew the difference between a flute and a clarinet and the difference between a trombone and a horn, and that they would go to the extent of commissioning Britain's greatest composer to make music for a film, which would be completely didactic about classical music. And that's such a wonderfully utopian thing to have done that it makes you quite nostalgic about the roots of this piece, as well as the fact that it's a great piece of music, I think.
And so did music stay with you during your university days when you left school? And did you have to place that behind you, or has it been a sort of constant companion through your life? Because you give the impression in Play It Again of you sort of almost returning to the piano as an adult.
Yes. Certainly at university, I played a lot. I played chamber music. When I was a young reporter on the Cambridge Evening News, I managed to get away in the evenings to play in the Cambridge Philharmonic Orchestra. I loved playing in orchestras. One of the great regrets of my life is now not to be playing in orchestras. It's just the most exciting thing imaginable. And then, you know, life, jobs, children, marriage, less and less time. So I never completely gave up. And, you know, I would play to the kids. But it was certainly in my mid to late 40s was the time when I thought, actually, music has been such an important part of my life and I can't let it go. So I started doing it quite seriously again.
So one thing that strikes me is that the Guardian has always been a strong champion of the arts. And was that something that really struck you, you know, having the musical background, that you were determined that the newspaper that you edited was always going to be strong on its music coverage?
Yes, I really felt that newspapers had a kind of duty to all the arts, but especially a paper like The Guardian, it seemed to me had a paper of a duty to the so-called high arts. Because you know, music needs audiences, it needs intelligent critics, intelligent contextualizers, friends. And a lot of Guardian readers, formed the majority of audiences at concert halls in the South Bank and the rest of Britain, of course, latterly the world. And so it seemed to be really important to have a team of extremely knowledgeable critics who could write about it. And I know newspapers are struggling at the moment in financially. But it still seems to me an important thing to be able to amplify and criticize the work of contemporary artists. So, yeah, it was an important part of the paper.
Are you going to any concerts at the moment? Have you been to any live concerts in the past sort of 6, 7, 8 months?
I haven't. That's terrible, and it's something that I missed. The last concert I went to was George Benjamin's 60th birthday concert at the Festival Hall, which must have been round about the beginning of March, maybe late February. And again, I remember Alfred Brendel was in the audience, and he was the only person in the audience wearing a face mask, which is completely mm-hmm. understandable at his age. And it was just before the lockdown. And sadly, I haven't been back to a concert since, and it's something I really miss.
Yes, I was going to say, do you palpably sort of feel that, because listening to music on CDs, listening to the radio, does that fill a gap? Do you actually miss the live experience?
Yes, I mean, I do think it's a miracle to live in the age of Spotify. I just do. you know, that all the music that's ever been written is sort of, you know, you can summon up, or YouTube. But that, nothing replaces the live experience and the sort of slight sense of danger and the not knowing what it's going to sound like, or and the and the business of being in the moment with hundreds of other people seems to add to the experience. And that sort of when it really works, when you've got, you know, 100, 200, 400, 1,000 people in a room, all totally silent and concentrated, experiencing the same thing or versions of the same thing, it's, you can't replace that. And the sooner we can get back to that, the, you know, something we all hope and pray for.
Which rather neatly leads me on to the question, which is the sort of best concert you think you've ever been to, the one you sometimes sort of think, gosh, you know, that really did affect me, and I was a changed man.
Yeah. Well, it's about Brendel again. And I was told that he was going to play his last concert in just before Christmas in 2008. I think he was 78, 79 at the time. So I immediately booked tickets to go to the Musik Verein, which is a, you know, legendary, beautiful hall in Vienna, because I just thought this is going to be an incredible moment to see Brendel play his last concert. He's been playing in and around Vienna for 60 years. And, you know, it's difficult to think of a figure who's still alive, who has that connection with a tradition of pre-war European music making. He studied with Edwin Fischer and grew up in Graz. And so there was this incredible sense of occasion. And the piece that he chose to play was the so-called Jeune Homme, Piano Concerto of Mozart, which is quite a youthful piece. He came on. So, the conductor was Sir Charles McCarris, who was even older than Brendel. And there was a sense of finality, but on Brendel's terms, because, you know, a lot of pianists sort of fade away, or they get arthritis, or they start forgetting the notes. And I think Brendel had decided he wanted to go out at his peak. At a moment of his own choosing, and everybody in the hall knew the significance of the occasion. And he came back and he played a couple of encores, and ending with that wonderful Busoni chorale, Nun komm der Heiden Heiland. Again, you know, I don't know what the Musik Verein holds, but maybe 2,000 people, absolutely silent. He bowed. There was a thunderous applause, and he gestured into the audience where his pupils were. So there was Till Fellner, Imogen Cooper, and Paul Lewis. Because he's never been a great prodigious teacher. He's had a few really distinguished, and he gestured towards them as if to say, "Okay, over to you." And it was just a magical occasion.
Oh, very, very touching, and actually I find it extraordinary that he hasn't made a comeback at all. I mean, he really has been true to his word. The final concert was the final concert.
No, I think it's just absolutely... well done him. I have, and I'm sure you have, heard pianists who don't know quite when to stop, and it can be sad, and it can be a bit embarrassing. And on that night, Brendel was fully in command of everything, and I think just to decide, okay, that's it. And as you say, he's got a life. He still lectures and talks, writes poetry. He still performs, but not on the keyboard.
Yes, it's funny. I was talking to David Zinman quite some years ago, and, you know, he would think he was celebrating his 70th birthday at the time. And he was saying, it's only now that I've really found that I'm getting good at this. You know, some musicians only really come into their prime much later. Yeah. I mean, look at Menahem Pressler in his 90s, yeah. You know, still playing wonderfully. So, and of course, musicians are very much hooked on that experience of playing to a live audience. It is their lifeblood. It is the thing that keeps them going. So, you know, I found that extraordinary with Brendel, that he could just suddenly stop.
Yeah, and you're right. I didn't know Brendel when he was a young player, but I understand that he really came into his own in his 40s. And it's rather lovely to see his pupil, Imogen Cooper, who, you know, I think is a great, great player, who has similarly, I mean, she's always been, you know, a very, very well-known pianist, but I think she's playing better now than ever. And it is a wonderful thing about, I mean, I bet it's not true of oboists or horn players. Or you just don't have the puff in your 60s, but it seems that pianists can go on well into their 70s, if not 80s, and have new things to tell us.
You talked about Spotify earlier. Do you do a lot of listening? Do you manage to get through a lot of listening? Do you keep up to date with new releases and what soloists are up to? And
not as much as I should. I'm sorry to say. I mean, actually, one of the nice things about the lockdown, my wife and I have sort of taken it in turns in the kitchen in the evenings, and I think we counted the other day, we've cooked 150 dinners for each other. And I tended to do that. I tend to start cooking around about 7, and I quite like that, whatever it's called at 7 o'clock on Radio 3, where it's a sort of blind tasting. You've no idea what's going to happen.
It's the mixtape, yes.
The mixtape. And then at 7:30, there's a concert, and it sort of put me back in love with Radio 3, which was a terribly important part of, you know, my musical education. I mean, it was, you know, back then, of course, you could buy records, but I, as a sort of young music student, you would buy the Radio Times and go through it with a sort of felt tip pen and mark up the pieces you wanted to hear and then try and be in for them. And, you know, times have moved on. Radio 3's function, I suppose, has changed in a bit. But just that business of cooking each evening for the last 7 months, listening to whatever's on Radio 3 between 7 and 9 o'clock has been really a lovely reintroduction of music back into the sort of daily rhythm of life.
Do you have a piece of music that you really couldn't live without, that you sort of return to time and time again?
The Beethoven C-sharp minor quartet, the Opus 131, is a piece that I think will live with me and absorb me for the rest of my days. Wrote a play about it, which I'm sure will never be performed. It's been sort of read by actors, but what interests me about it is that its composition almost exactly coincides with a great trauma in Beethoven's life. He had adopted his nephew Karl, and you can imagine for a young teenager to be living with Beethoven must have been really difficult. There were some Viennese psychoanalysts in the 1950s who went back through all Beethoven's conversation books and sort of analysed the relationship and thought Beethoven was, in a way, in love with this boy. Anyway, in 1826, as Beethoven is writing this piece, Karl tries to kill himself. He shoots himself. And that sort of glimpse of the emotional background of this piece, and which begins with an extraordinarily dissonant fugue, and has the most extremes of emotions. And I think the reason those late Beethoven works are so extraordinary is because it's all laid out for you to hear. This was the only way that Beethoven could describe what he was going through, and music was the only way that he could resolve it. Now, I think today you would go and see a shrink or you would take some pills and you would do your best to iron out these highs and lows, but not in those days. And so what goes down on the page are these incredible, unmediated contrasts of despair and joy. Sometimes in the space of 4 or 5 bars, he'll just stop the despair and move into the joy, and then stop the joy and move into the despair. And it's the most extraordinary picture of a mind in turmoil. There are 7 movements. It's a huge piece. And as I say, I think you can go on listening to that for the rest of your life and still not get to understand even half of what's going on.
I want to move entirely differently to talk about the fact that you play a Fazioli piano. And do you still have your Fazioli?
Yeah.
Yes. What sort of turned you onto that sort of style of piano? Because, of course, you know, everyone plays a Steinway, and you know that is usually the instrument most people aspire to. But what was it about the Fazioli's that really grabbed you?
Well, when I started taking up the piano again in my late 40s, early 50s, I had a music teacher in Kentish Down, an American pianist called Michael Shack. And I was looking for a piano at the time because I'd been playing on my mother's baby grand Challon, which was fine, but only fine. And Michael said, I've just played on the most amazing instrument I've ever played on. And one of his pupils had bought a Fazioli. I'd never heard of them. And they're handmade just outside Venice by Paolo Fazioli, who's a sort of, I think his parents were engineers and furniture makers, and he was an engineer and a musician. Between them, they thought they could build a better piano than a Steinway. Well, is it or isn't it? But there are some pianists, notably Angela Hewitt, who will play nothing else, and she's got 4 or 5 of them. But I think it's very difficult to break the stranglehold that Steinway has got on the market. But the one I have is a beautiful instrument, and I rather love the sort of story of craftsmanship and passion that goes into these instruments.
Didn't you go out and see it made? Was that?
No, I did. I mean, I was so unknowledgeable at that point that I bought it sight unseen, which is something I would never do now. And luckily, it was a wonderful. It came from Holland. And finally, I'd just moved house in London, and I was in a Victorian semi. And I've just moved into a flat, which was a polytechnic with sort of concrete floors and very high ceilings. Mm-hmm. And it sounds completely different. And it sounds it sounded pretty good in the Victorian semi, but it sounds wonderful in this new room. So I'm very, very happy with it.
Very good, very good. What would you say your sort of current musical obsession, as it were, might be? If you come across anything that is grabbing you now.
I know exactly what it is, because when I turned up at Lady Margaret Hall hoping, that somebody might take pity on me and want to play with me, the wonderful emeritus professor of music, she was just stepping down, Susan Wallenberg, who has spent her whole life in Oxford, was the first woman professor of music at Oxford, and is a Schubert scholar of great distinction. And for the last 3 or 4 years, we've just been working our way through the Schubert forehand repertoire in ways that have surprised even her. And so there were pieces that she didn't know. So I guess, any half-decent pianist has thrashed their way through the F minor fantasy. But there are so many other pieces. I think my favourite is the variations on original theme in a flat major, D813, which is just a gorgeous huge piece. I mean, they're all huge, these pieces of music. There's the rondo in A major. There's the C major sonata, which is, you know, built on an orchestral scale, the so-called grand duo. So there are all these sort of pieces, I think, as good as the F minor fantasy, that are much less well known. And Susan and I have been that's been our life together, just playing these pieces for the last, as I say, 3 or 4 years.
I do play some of the Schubert duets, but I think the F minor is possibly one of his greatest piano works. And I think simply the fact that it's a duet means that it either doesn't get performed or it's not really sort of drawn into that collection of works such as the late sonatas are.
No, I think they're great, great pieces. And I think you're right that somehow people, I don't know if they look down on forehand music or they don't take it as seriously, but I played those variations with somebody used to teach me, Hilary Dame Wetton, and he had never heard this piece, and yet it's a you know, big 20 minutes full of heartache and beauty, but I think most people just don't know it.
Absolutely, and Richard key changes as well. Goodness me!
Yeah, I know. Well, that's the thing about Schubert, isn't it? You think sometimes, because I mean, of course, everything is now arranged, and you go on Imslip, Petrucci, and everything is arranged for everything. So if you want to play your way through Winterreiser for four hands
or ring cycle,
it's all there, anything. But you're right, with Schubert, you just think. Actually, in the last movement of the, the rondo, he just goes on and on, almost showing off. You know, I can do that. You want it in this key? I can do it. I can do it in this key. Oh, let's do an enharmonic shift into this key. And you just think, I have no idea where this is going. Oh, we're back in tonic. It's like sort of, you know, the cleverest boy in class who can just dazzling you with his technique.
Yes, it's probably one of the duets you can't play with a gin and tonic on the piano. Most of the time you can, but
this
one you need all your faculties.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Alan Rusbridger, thank you very much indeed.
That was great. Good to talk.
That was Alan Rusbridger talking to me, Oliver Condy. We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the team at BBC Music Magazine. Do let us know what you think of it by rating and reviewing it wherever you've been listening. If you want to find out more about BBC Music Magazine, we're available in print and various digital formats, or you can visit our website, classical-music.com, where you can read all about the latest music happenings, read thousands of reviews, and a good deal more. Thank you to Acast for hosting this podcast, and to our producers, Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman.